This 51st chapter is concerned in the first 8 verses primarily with God talking to his people who are in captivity. He's talking to the Israelites, or to the people of Judea, who are in the captivity of Babylon, and he's explaining their situation and explaining how he's going to redeem them. But everything that he says to them about their captivity also applies to us about our captivity in sin, and as he leads us out of sin, and as he is our Father. So we have a lesser fulfillment and a greater fulfillment of this prophecy, but because much of it does relate to the times of the Messiah, which is our time today. And then, of course, there are other fulfillments of it that could occur in our individual lives as we find ourselves individually trapped and in a state of captivity and not knowing which way to turn, not knowing when redemption or release is going to come, but yet we wait upon the Lord, and he does then give us that release as he has done time and time again to his people. So he begins this 51st chapter in the first verse by saying, "Hearken to me." And he's really talking about himself now. Me here means God. Hearken to God. Listen to God. Hearken to me, ye that follow after righteousness, ye that seek the Lord. Now these are his people. Even though they're in captivity, there is people who still are remaining faithful. They're trying to follow after righteousness. They're trying to seek the Lord. And certainly we'd like to think that we would fit into that category ourselves today. He says, listen to me, you that are following after righteousness, you that seek after the Lord. Look unto the rock whence ye are hewn, and to the hole of the pit whence ye are digged. Now, what he means here when he says, look unto the rock whence ye are hewn, he's talking about there the fact that they are being taken out of a quarry. This is a picture of a stone quarry, and each one is a rough, unfinished rock still in the quarry before he has God to change him, and then God hews him out of the quarry and makes him a polished, fitted stone ready to go into his temple. And so he says, look unto the rock whence ye are hewn, and to the hole of the pit whence ye are digged. Look where you came from. Look where you've been in the past. You think you have troubles now? Just look how it was with you before I ever worked on you, before I ever took you as my people, before I ever changed you into a suitable a portion here for my household. And true it is, when we're Christians, times never get so bad with us as they were back before we were taken out of the quarry, while we were still in the hole, while we were still in the pit. They never get so bad with us as when we were in that roughened, unfinished, and worldly, and state of absolute total ignorance about the true God. And this is really brought to light in a couple of New Testament statements. Jesus says in Matthew 3, verse 9, he might have alluded to this and might not, but it still is fitting. As he was talking to those Pharisees who were so wicked and who were so self-righteous, Jesus said to them, And think not to say within yourselves, we have Abraham to our father, for I say unto you that God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. So what Jesus said is given more emphasis when we see what Isaiah says about it. But I'd like to turn to 1 Peter 2, verses 4 and 5. Peter says, to whom coming as unto a living stone, disallowed indeed of men, but chosen of God and precious. Now he's talking about the Savior. He calls him a living stone, a stone that was disallowed indeed of men. This is 1 Peter 2, verse 4. But chosen of God and precious. And so he says, ye also as lively stones. Now that's us. We're the Christians. Ye also as lively stones are built up a spiritual house and holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. So we then are the spiritual house. Each one of us who have been hewn out of the quarry, who have been taken out of the pit, formerly a rough, unfitted stone, now a smooth and polished and well-dimensioned a stone here, a lively stone or a living stone. We're built up into this spiritual house, so that the house of God then is composed of his, of the members of his household. We then, each one of us, compose a part of that house. We're a stone in the house, in the work of the house. And he says here that we are living stones, which means that we're not just stones that are put there and nothing ever changes, but we grow and we mature, and our faith and our love and our ability to serve gets better as we go along. So that we're a living stone, not a dead stone, but a living stone. And that's the description that Peter gives, which also fits here with this idea of a stone being taken from the quarry, being hewn from the pit, and then made for God's building. So that's one description that he gives of where they were before God worked on them, before God changed their lives. The next verse he says, "Look unto Abraham your father, and unto Sarah that bare you. For I called him alone and blessed him and increased him." Now he takes the fact that they had come from Abraham. John says the Lord is able to raise up these stones, children unto Abraham. Abraham was their forefather. He's also our forefather. We are still the children of Abraham today. But he says, "Look unto Abraham your father and to Sarah that bare you. For I called him alone and blessed him and increased him." Abraham started out at just one. Just Abraham. It wasn't any great mighty nation, any great power. Just Abraham. He called him alone. But he made him a mighty nation. He blessed him. He increased him. So that Abraham then had this great land of Canaan that he was to inherit. Abraham had the great nation of the Israelites that were his people, his descendants. But it just started off with one. Now, if God was able to start with such a humble beginning in the case of Abraham and grew into this mighty nation and this mighty people, and even today in Christianity it's spread all over the world, starting with the one man, Abraham, certainly then he's able to bless you in your trials and in your afflictions, and he can release you no matter what the problem may be. So if Abraham could be blessed, then so could they be blessed. That's what he's concluding here. So in verse 3 he says, "For the Lord shall comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places. And he will make her wilderness like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the Lord." So he's showing then how he's going to change Zion. Zion, of course, was in a state of captivity. Zion was in a condition of not even existing as a nation. No doubt those Israelite people, as they looked around there in Babylon, here they were, not even citizens, you might say. They didn't even have a country. They had no formal worship. We don't know what they were able to do there in Babylon. Maybe this is where the synagogues arose and they began to worship in synagogues, because we don't have any Bible origin of how those synagogues started. But they could think, what's going to ever become of us? Here we, the mighty people of God, an independent nation, pure and free from all the other influences of these other nations, here we are, nothing, completely at the mercy of our captors. And so God is calling upon them to look and to see how that he can change things. And you know, it's easy for us in the church today to think the same thing. We, the true church, is this the church that the Lord established? Such a miserable, beggarly little insignificant group of people? Are we the church, really? Is this the way God is having things? We can get ourselves to thinking the same way those people were thinking when they were captives in Babylon. And of course, what applies to one applies to the other. So he says, just look how you were before I hewed you out of the quarry. And look to your father Abraham. I just started off with one and I blessed him. And so he says, "For the Lord shall comfort Zion." The time's coming when you're going to be comforted. "He will comfort all her waste places. He will make her wilderness like Eden." Now, of course, she had grown up into a desolate wilderness area. And he says, the Lord's going to make it like Eden, like the Garden of Eden, you know. And her desert, like the Garden of the Lord, which we read about there in Genesis, the 2nd chapter and the 8th verse. Then he concludes that verse by saying, "Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody." So in Zion, there was going to be joy, and there was going to be gladness there. There was going to be thanksgiving and the voice of melody. Now, all those things should be in the church today also. We have joy and we have gladness and we also have thanksgiving. Let's not allow ourselves to get into the position of where we don't have any more joy. where we're not able to have any gladness, where we cannot rejoice because of the great blessings that are ours. Let's never get into that position. Let us also have thanksgiving. Every way that the Lord has blessed us, let us be thankful for it. And you know, as we stop and look at our individual positions in this life today, we have to look back and see how that we have been bountifully blessed by the Lord. How is it that I am where I am in the progression of Christianity? How is it that I know about Him, that I can study the Bible? How is it that I know what I know about how to make a living? How is it that I have what I have in the way of a family, or in the way of my health, or in the way of my ability to get along? How do I have these things? Surely the Lord has blessed us. And so we have thanksgiving. Let's not fail to thank Him for the things that He's done for us. And then he says, and the voice of melody. Now that phrase there, voice of melody, simply means a song. There is singing in the church. And it's done with the voice. It's voice singing. The voice of melody. Well, in verse 4, he begins to show how that this salvation, this great righteousness of God is going to spread. He says, hearken unto me, my people, and give ear unto me, O my nation. Listen to me, you, my people, my nation. Listen to what I'm going to say. For a law shall proceed from me, and I will make my judgment to rest for a light of the people. Now he says, a law shall proceed from me. You know, most people who claim to be Christians today really do not believe that the Lord has made a law in the New Testament age. They think that the New Testament has just freedom from all law, that there's not any law left now, that they don't have to follow any kind of law. All they have to do is just kind of have some kind of a belief that He did exist, and some kind of a sense of loyalty, and some willy-nilly little plan, and you don't really even have to follow that, because you're just going to get there some way or another, and there's not hardly anybody going to lose if they just believe Him. But he says, a law shall proceed from me. Now, if there's a law, that means that there is the possibility of either obeying it or disobeying it. There's something to be done. There's something to be obeyed. Something to be heeded to. And it's not just a belief, but it is a law shall proceed from me. And I will make my judgment, that is, I will make my law or my statute to rest for a light of the people. I'm going to set this law, I'm going to set this judgment up here, this statute that I'm going to make, I'm going to set it up for it to be a light of the people. That's where you get your enlightenment. That's where you learn about God, is to learn about His law and to be obedient and subjective in subjection to it. And he's really saying here also in this verse that his religion, his law, is going to be for all the nations. It's going to spread to everybody. It's going to be a light of the people. My righteousness is near. My salvation has gone forth. And mine arms shall judge the people. And this word here, arms, means his power, his ability to do and to perform. My arms shall judge the people. The isle shall wait upon me, and on mine arm shall they trust. And this word here, isle, simply means the distant lands. Not just is it going to be now confined to Judea and to Palestine, but it's going to be the isles, the distant lands. They're going to wait on me, and on mine arm shall they trust. And so he's simply showing here in prophecy that this thing would be spread beyond the confines of the land of Israel. His way, his will, his law, his people would be spread out over the entire face of the earth among the distant lands. And so he says in verse 6, lift up your eyes to the heavens and look upon the earth beneath. Now, if there's anything in this life that we can look at and think that it is stable and think that there's not going to be any change, any shaking, any alteration of it, that it's always been this way, it'd be to look up to the heavens and to see the heavenly bodies, the sun, the stars, the moon, the sky, as this continues unchanged day after day after day, and year after year, and lifetime after lifetime. Or to look down to the earth beneath and see how that it's the same. The earth really hasn't changed. Old terra firma here, it's just staying like it always has, and like our forefathers had. We make a living out of the soil just like they did, and we try to live off of the things that come from the soil. So this looks like stability. So he says, look at this heaven and look at the earth. For the heavens shall vanish away like smoke, and the earth shall wax old like a garment, and they that dwell therein shall die in like manner. You think you have stability here? Nothing here is stable. The heavens are going to vanish like a smoke. It's going to melt. And the people who live here, he says, they're going to die in like manner. And this phrase, in like manner, means they're going to die like flies or they're going to die like gnats. That's what the true meaning of those words are. They're going to die like flies or gnats. But my salvation shall be forever, and my righteousness shall not be abolished. So the only thing stable, the only thing that we can look to in this life that has any kind of true foundation and stability and is not going to be moved or altered or changed or made to disappear is what he calls here my salvation and my righteousness. He says, my salvation shall be forever, and my righteousness shall not be abolished. So no physical change is going to come to harm those who have the righteousness of God. In Matthew 24, verse 35, Jesus said, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. And no doubt he had reference to this very fact here. These things are all going to pass away. The most stable thing you can name, that you can feature, that you can look upon, it's going to pass away. But my righteousness, he said, is not going to pass away. It shall not be abolished, and my salvation shall be forever. So when we have that, when we have his salvation and we have his righteousness, we have the one thing that's stable and that will not be changed, that will not be taken away. So we're going to conclude at that verse, verse 6. Then next time, Lord willing, we'll begin with the 7th verse of this 51st chapter of Isaiah.